This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Gordon Mackenzie. Scaramouche, A Romance of the French Revolution by Raphael Sabatini. Book 3, Chapter 15. Safe Conduct. Across the body of that convulsively sobbing woman, the mother of one and the mistress of the other, the eyes of those mortal enemies met, invested with a startled, appalled interest that admitted of no words. Beyond the table, as if turned to stone by this culminating horror of revelation, stood Aline. Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr was the first to stir. Into his bewildered mind came the memory of something that Madame de Plougastel had said of a letter that was on the table. He came forward, unhindered. The announcement made, Madame de Plougastel no longer feared the sequel, and so she let him go. He walked unsteadily past this new-found son of his, and took up the sheet that lay beside the candle-branch. A long moment he stood reading it, none heeding him. Aline's eyes were all on André Louis, full of wonder and commiseration, whilst André Louis was staring down in stupefied fascination at his mother. Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr read the letter slowly through. Then, very quietly, he replaced it. His next concern, being the product of an artificial age sternly schooled in the suppression of emotion, was to compose himself. Then he stepped back to Madame de Plougastel's side and stooped to raise her. "Therese," he said. Obeying by instinct the implied command, she made an effort to rise and to control herself in her turn. The Marquis half-conducted, half-carried her to the armchair by the table. André Louis looked on. Still numbed and bewildered, he made no attempt to assist. He saw, as in a dream, the Marquis bending over Madame de Plougastel. As in a dream, he heard him ask, "How long have you known this, Therese?"
I have always known it. Always. I confided him to Kercadiou. I saw him once, as a child. Oh, but what of that?
Why was I never told? Why did you deceive me? Why did you tell me that this child had died a few days after birth? Why, Therese? Why?
I was afraid. I thought it better so that nobody, not even you, should know. And nobody has known, save Quinton, until last night, when, to induce him to come here and save me, he was forced to tell him.
But I, Therese, the Marquis insisted. It was my right to know.
Your right? What could you have done? Acknowledge him? And then, ha!
It was a queer, desperate note of laughter.
There was Plougastel. There was my family. And there was you. You, yourself, who had ceased to care, in whom the fear of discovery had stifled love. Why should I have told you, then? Why? I should not have told you now, had there been any other way to save you both. Once before I suffered just such dreadful apprehensions when you and he fought in the Bois. I was on my way to prevent it when you met me. I would have divulged the truth as a last resource to avert that horror. But mercifully, God spared me the necessity then."
It had not occurred to any of them to doubt her statement, incredible though it might seem. Had any done so, her present words must have resolved all doubt, explaining as they did much that to each of her listeners had been obscure until this moment. Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr, overcome, reeled away to a chair and sat down heavily. Losing command of himself for a moment, he took his haggard face in his hands. Through the windows open to the garden came from the distance the faint throbbing of a drum to remind them of what was happening around them, but the sound went unheeded. To each it must have seemed that here they were face to face with a horror greater than any that might be tormenting Paris. At last André Louis began to speak, his voice level and unutterably cold. "Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr," he said, "I trust that you'll agree that this disclosure, which can hardly be more distasteful and horrible to you than it is to me, alters nothing, since it effaces nothing of all that lies between us. Or, if it alters anything, it is merely to add something to that score. And yet, oh, but what can it avail to talk? Here, monsieur, take this safe conduct which is made out for Madame de Plougastel's footman, and with it make your escape as best you can. In return, I will beg of you the favor never to allow me to see you or hear of you again."
"André!"
His mother swung upon him with that cry, and yet again that question.
"Have you no heart? What has he ever done to you that you should nurse so bitter a hatred of him?"
"You shall hear, madam. Once 2 years ago in this very room, I told you of a man who had brutally killed my dearest friend and debauched the girl I was to have married. Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr is that man." A moan was her only answer. She covered her face with her hands. The Marquis rose slowly to his feet again. He came slowly forward, his smoldering eyes scanning his son's face. "You are hard," he said grimly, "but I recognize the hardness. It derives from the blood you bear." "Spare me that," said André Louis. The Marquis inclined his head. "I will not mention it again. But I desire that you should at least understand me. And you too, Therese. You accuse me, sir, of murdering your dearest friend. I will admit that the means employed were, perhaps, unworthy. But what other means were at my command to meet an urgency that every day since then proves to have existed? Monsieur de Vilmorin was a revolutionary, a man of new ideas that should overthrow society and rebuild it more akin to the desires of such as himself. I belonged to the order that quite as justifiably desired society to remain as it was. Not only was it better so for me and mine, but I also contend, and you have yet to prove me wrong, that it is better so for all the world, that indeed no other conceivable society is possible. Every human society must of necessity be composed of several strata. You may disturb it temporarily into an amorphous whole by a revolution such as this, but only temporarily. Soon, out of the chaos which is all that you and your kind can ever produce, order must be restored or life will perish. And with the restoration of order comes the restoration of the various strata necessary to organized society. Those that were yesterday at the top may, in the new order of things, find themselves dispossessed, without any benefit to the whole. That change I resisted. The spirit of it I fought with whatever weapons were available, whenever and wherever I encountered it. Monsieur de Vilmorin was an incendiary of the worst type, a man of eloquence full of false ideals that misled poor, ignorant men into believing that the change proposed could make the world a better place for them. You are an intelligent man, and I defy you to answer me from your heart and conscience that such a thing was true or possible. You know that it is untrue. You know that it is a pernicious doctrine. And what made it worse on the lips of Monsieur de Vilmorin was that he was sincere and eloquent. His voice was a danger that must be removed, silenced. So much was necessary in self-defense. In self-defense, I did it. I had no grudge against Monsieur de Vilmorin. He was a man of my own class, a gentleman of pleasant ways, amiable, estimable, and able. You conceive me slaying him for the very lust of slaying, like some beast of the jungle flinging itself upon its natural prey. That has been your error from the first. I did what I did with the very heaviest heart. Oh, spare me your sneer. I do not lie. I have never lied. And I swear to you here and now, by my every hope of heaven, that what I say is true. I loathed the thing I did. Yet for my own sake and for the sake of my order, I must do it. Ask yourself whether Monsieur de Vilmorin would have hesitated for a moment, if by procuring my death he could have brought the utopia of his dreams a moment nearer realization. After that, you determined that the sweetest vengeance would be to frustrate my ends by reviving in yourself the voice that I had silenced. By yourself carrying forward the fantastic apostleship of equality that was Monsieur de Vilmorin's, you lacked the vision that would have shown you that God did not create men equals. Well, you are in case tonight to judge which of us was right, which wrong. You see what is happening here in Paris. You see the foul specter of anarchy stalking through a land fallen into confusion. Probably you have enough imagination to conceive something of what must follow. And do you deceive yourself that out of this filth and ruin there will rise up an ideal form of society? Don't you understand that society must reorder itself presently out of all this? But why say more? I must have said enough to make you understand the only thing that really matters. That I killed Monsieur de Vilmorin, as a matter of duty to my order. And the truth, which though it may offend you, should also convince you, is that tonight I can look back on that deed with equanimity, without a single regret, apart from what lies between you and me. When, kneeling beside the body of your friend that day at Gavrillac, you insulted and provoked me, had I been the tiger you conceived me, I must have killed you too. I am, as you may know, a man of quick passions. Yet I curbed the natural anger you aroused in me, because I could forgive an affront to myself where I could not overlook a calculated attack upon my order." He paused a moment. André Louis stood rigid, listening and wondering. So too the others. Then M. le Marquis resumed, on a note of less assurance. "In the matter of Mademoiselle Binet, I was unfortunate. I wronged you through inadvertence. I had no knowledge of the relations between you." André Louis interrupted him sharply at last with a question. "Would it have made a difference if you had?" "No," he was answered frankly. "I have the faults of my kind. I cannot pretend that any such scruple as you suggest would have weighed with me. But can you, if you are capable of any detached judgment, blame me very much for that? All things considered, monsieur, I am rapidly being forced to the conclusion that it is impossible to blame any man for anything in this world, that we are all of us the sport of destiny. Consider, monsieur, this gathering, this family gathering here tonight, whilst out there... Oh, my God! Let us make an end. Let us go our ways and write Finis to this horrible chapter of our lives." Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr considered him gravely, sadly, in silence for a moment. "Perhaps it is best," he said at length in a small voice. He turned to Madame de Plougastel. "If a wrong I have to admit in my life, a wrong that I must bitterly regret, it is the wrong that I have done to you, my dear." "Not now, Gervais, not now," she faltered, interrupting him. "Now, for the first and the last time, I am going. It is not likely that we shall ever meet again, that I shall ever see any of you again. You, who should have been the nearest and dearest to me. We are all, he says, the sport of destiny. Ah, but not quite. Destiny is an intelligent force moving with purpose. In life we pay for the evil that in life we do. That is the lesson that I have learnt tonight. By an act of betrayal I begot, unknown to me, a son, who, whilst as ignorant as myself of our relationship, has come to be the evil genius of my life, to cross and thwart me, and finally to help to pull me down in ruin. It is just, poetically just. My full and resigned acceptance of that fact is the only atonement I can offer you." He stooped and took one of Madame's hands that lay limply in her lap. "Goodbye, Therese." His voice broke. He had reached the end of his iron self-control. She rose and clung to him a moment, unashamed before them. The ashes of that dead romance had been deeply stirred this night, and deep down some lingering embers had been found that glowed brightly now before their final extinction. Yet she made no attempt to detain him. She understood that their son had pointed out the only wise, the only possible course, and was thankful that M. de La Tour d'Azyr accepted it.
"God keep you, Gervais," she murmured. "You will take the safe conduct, and you will let me know when you are safe."
He held her face between his hands an instant, then, very gently, kissed her and put her from him. Standing erect and outwardly calm again, he looked across at André Louis, who was proffering him a sheet of paper. "It is the safe conduct. Take it, monsieur. It is my first and last gift to you, and certainly the last gift I should ever have thought of making you. The gift of life. In a sense, it makes us quits. The irony, sir, is not mine, but fate's. Take it, monsieur, and go in peace." Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr took it. His eyes looked hungrily into the lean face confronting him, so sternly set. He thrust the paper into his bosom, and then, abruptly, convulsively, held out his hand. His son's eyes asked a question.
"Let there be peace between us, in God's name," said the Marquis thickly.
Pity stirred at last in André Louis. Some of the sternness left his face. He sighed.
"Goodbye, monsieur," he said. "You are hard," his father told him, speaking wistfully. "But perhaps you are in the right so to be. In other circumstances, I should have been proud to have owned you as my son. As it is..."
He broke off abruptly, and as abruptly added,
"Goodbye."
He loosed his son's hand and stepped back. They bowed formally to each other, and then M. de La Tour d'Azyr bowed to Mademoiselle de Kercadiou in utter silence, a bow that contained something of utter renunciation, of finality. That done, he turned and walked stiffly out of the room, and so out of all their lives. Months later, they were to hear of him in the service of the Emperor of Austria. End of Book 3, Chapter 15.